All right, if you haven't turned to Acts chapter 9, that's where we'd like to direct you, Acts chapter 9, verses 12 and 13. As you're getting there, let's remember a little bit of what's taking place in the chapter. You have Saul of Tarsus. He's met up with Jesus on the road, and he's been blinded. We're going to read a little bit more about that. There was something like scales that ended up in his eyes. Now he's told to go into the city, and he's going to receive some information as far as what he needs to do. So he finally gets into the city, told to go. Ananias is also getting some information, and you have, picking up with Acts 9, 12, and 13, these words, "And he hath seen a man named Ananias coming in." Now this is God speaking to Ananias and telling him what Saul has seen. "He's seen a man named Ananias," that of course would be you, "coming in and laying his hands on him, that he may receive his sight. But Ananias answered, 'Lord, I have heard from many of this man, how much evil he did to thy saints at Jerusalem. Here he hath authority from the chief priests to bind all that call upon thy name.'" It's kind of interesting to me that as God is communicating with Saul, he's also communicating with Ananias. We find sometimes that people have difficulty running on, we might say, two tracks. They're dealing with this situation, and over here they may struggle to deal with this situation. But when you think about God, how many things is he balancing at one time? And I'm not looking for a literal number. A lot. I mean, it's worldwide. And even among the angels, he's trying to keep some things going up there. But this person's praying for rain, this person's praying for no rain. And over here, you've got this person who's sick, and over here, this person is going through this, that, and the other thing. And they've had at least one movie. I think it was Morgan Freeman. He was given the opportunity to be God, and he thought that would be just great. And then all of a sudden, the prayer requests start, you know, coming in. And he's thinking, this is going to be fun, but it's kind of like, wow. It's like messages in the email box or messages on the answering machine. They start stacking up very, very quickly. And it would be something if you could have just a day to be God and see all the requests that were coming in. But God's working on multiple fronts. We're going to see that in the next chapter, won't we? What do we find in Acts chapter 10? Anybody recall? Who's the preacher that goes to the house of somebody who's not a Jew? No. Peter goes to the house of Cornelius. So Cornelius is, of course, the one who's not the Christian. But Peter makes the point, your prayers have gone up as a memorial before God, and your alms as well. So he's working in the life of Cornelius. He's also working in the life of Peter with that vision to get Peter to the household of Cornelius. What about in the previous chapter, Acts chapter 8? Do you see both God working in the life of a Christian and a non-Christian? We've got this fellow, he's riding where? All right, he's riding back to his homeland in the chariot. And who's the preacher that God's working through? That would be Philip. So once again, chapters 8, chapters 9, chapters 10, in the book of Acts you have God working in the lives of a Christian and a non-Christian. Now the flip side of that, sometimes it's good to consider two sides of something. Would you say that there's a flip side to what we just discussed? God's working in the life of a Christian and a non-Christian. Is the flip side of that true? If it's not God, then it's going to be the devil, Satan. Would you say that Satan seeks to work in the life of the Christian and the non-Christian? Sure. So that's kind of interesting. You look at it from God's perspective and you say, wow, there's a lot going on there. But when you throw Satan into the mix, that really makes things interesting. So day in and day out, the devil and God are working in the lives of people, whether they're saved or not. Anything that you want to add or ask before we make some more points? Let's move down to this. We don't know how much communication God had with Saul during the 3 days that Saul was praying, Acts 9, verses 9 and 11. But we do know that God did have some communication with Saul during this three-day period before he gets his sight back. And some of this is found a little later in the book of Acts. Let's have somebody read Acts 26, verses 13 through 19. Now, that's a longer reading. It's about six verses, but it's really important at any time as you look at Saul's life, but especially as we're going through the first account of his conversion back here in Acts chapter 9. Acts 26, verses 13 to 19. Who has it or is about there and wants to read it? Jeff?
Scroll there.
Okay.
"At midday, O king, I saw in the way a light from heaven above the brightness of the sun shining round about me and them which journeyed with me. And when we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice speaking unto me and saying in the Hebrew tongue, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? It's hard for thee to kick against the pricks. And I said, Who art thou, Lord? And he said, I am Jesus, whom thou persecutest. But arise and stand upon thy feet, for I have appeared unto thee for this purpose, to make thee a minister and a witness both of these things which thou hast seen, and of those things in which I will appear unto thee, delivering from thee the people and from the Gentiles unto whom now I send thee, to open their eyes and to turn them from darkness to light and from the power of Satan unto God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and inheritance among them which are sanctified by faith that is in me. Whereupon, O King Agrippa, I was not disobedient unto the heavenly vision.
Okay, now you think about Saul. You have committed your life to doing everything that you can to stop Christianity. You're on the way to the city of Damascus, and you intend to bind Christians and bring them back to Jerusalem. You have this great experience on the road, and think about all the stuff that happens. Number one, you have Jesus appearing to Saul, and he speaks in the Hebrew language. And then you have Jesus saying, hey, Paul, guess what? I know what you are headed to do, but you are going to have a change in your life. You're going to become what? You're going to become a minister, same idea, either word that you choose. You're going to be a servant, or you're going to be a minister for whom? For me, no longer the Jews. And not only are you going to become a servant slash minister, you're also going to become a witness. Wow, that's going to change things a good bit. And he says you're going to be a servant, a witness to various people, some of whom are the Gentiles. How do you think that that would have struck a Pharisee of the Pharisee? Yeah, you can kind of understand now why he's still down on the ground a little bit. It's kind of like, well, this is not what I expected. I'm going to send you, and I'm going to use you to turn people from the devil. Don't you think that Paul, as he was on his way to this city, was thinking that these Christians have been taken by the devil? They have left the true God. They're in league with Satan. And he said, I'm going to help you bring people out of sin. Well, Paul is a Jew. He was thinking, well, you know, we've got this solution for sin, and that's the Old Testament system through Moses. And then God also talks about the inheritance. So as Paul is on the road, he hears stuff which must have been absolutely shocking. And again, I think that helps explain why he stayed down on the ground, and as we talked about, the other fellas got up. But he's received all that information. He's got 3 days to continue to process all that information. And now God, during this three-day period, is also adding some other details, as we see in Acts chapter 9. God says, look, somebody's going to show up on your doorstep. There's going to be a visitor. And God said, not only is somebody going to come, did God give him the name of this guy? He did. He said, the fellow who's going to come to you is going to be named Ananias. We'll say a little bit more about him in a bit. And not only is Ananias going to come to you, God said he's going to tell you, or I'm going to tell you, or I'm not going to tell you what he's going to do for you. I am going to tell you. And this is what he's going to do for you. You're going to get your sight back. Now, Saul surely had been wondering about whether or not he was going to get a sight back. Now, you would think that if God's going to do all this stuff for you and through you, you're probably going to have your sight restored. But again, there's no guarantee of that. So I still think he may have been wondering about the restoration of his sight. We've talked before about the laying on of hands, so we're not going to rehash that material today. But I will make this note. I think as I read that from Acts 9, verse, is it 13 or 14? Or was it 12? Yeah. Laying his hands, plural, on you. Anybody have the word hand singular? Okay, so if you caught that as I was reading that, that wasn't a mispronunciation by me. There is a manuscript variation. So some manuscripts say hand, some say hands. It's not a big deal. But if you were comparing multiple translations and you saw the difference and you thought, hey, what's going on? The answer would be just like we have some other things. Now, just a quick footnote to that. You will have sometimes some people raise their hands and say, well, the Bible has all kinds of contradictions. Well, my question is, what do you mean by that? A lot of times people say you have a manuscript variation. Some say hands, some say hands, and they'll count that as a contradiction. No, you have that as a spelling difference. But a lot of times when people will say, well, there are thousands of discrepancies in the Bible. Again, what do you mean by discrepancy? And you have people copying these. We have thousands of copies and can go back and see which one appears to be the right one. But even when you go back and you stack all those things up, it simply does not change any doctrinal point in the scriptures. Okay. Was there a point about that? It sounded like somebody was going to raise their hand. Okay. Do we want the fans on? Anybody hot? Anybody cold? All right. Let's balance it out and say we'll put one set of fans on. How about that? Tim, you want to turn the fans on back there?
Where do you turn on it?
Right there, you'll see the bank of buttons.
It says fans right on.
Yeah.
This one here?
Well, I'm not going to choose for you. You choose. And that way, if somebody's unhappy after class, they can see you. So.
I don't know which one does what.
It's labeled, or at least it used to be labeled.
No,
Okay. Whatever is not on, flick a... That should do it.
They're all the same.
All right, well, okay. All right, maybe we'll shut them halfway off if people get cold. So we'll do it that way. Can't please everybody all the time. Okay. Thank you very much. Could God have healed Saul's blindness without human intervention? Sure, but he didn't, and I think that's interesting. You have, too, the choice of Ananias, and that's very interesting. Why does he come, and why does he lay his hands on Saul? Well, sometimes a personal touch is a good thing. We do know that there was the gift of healing. There were some people who had that. That was through the laying on the apostles' hands, Acts chapter 8 and verse 18, and maybe Ananias had that gift. Or maybe that was not how it worked. There's just a lot of details about the account that were simply not given. I do think that as you look at who came, Ananias, he's a fellow that we have almost no information about in Scripture other than he was in this community. He was a fellow who was selected to go see Saul. He's spoken of in very glowing terms as we look at some other passages, and especially here in Acts chapter 9. But why perhaps did God not choose another apostle? Why not send like Peter, like he does to Cornelius in Acts chapter 10? Why not choose John or somebody else? Why choose this guy who is well respected by people, but we know very little about?
Sometimes God just chooses the simple.
Okay. All right. I think that might be a good thing to consider. Let's take a look at Galatians chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. Galatians 2, 11 and 12. Who has it and is ready to read? Tina?
Now when Peter had come to Antioch, I withstood him to his face, because he was to be blamed. For before certain men came from James, he would eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing those who were of circumcision.
Was that Galatians 2?
Yeah.
11 and 12.
Well, I had a wrong reference. I checked that. Maybe it's chapter 1. Paul said, I didn't receive my apostleship of men. I'm sorry, it should have been chapter 1, 11 and 12. Would you back up, Tina?
Yep. But I make known to you, brethren, that the gospel which was preached by me is not according to men, for I neither received it from men, nor was I taught it, but it came through the revelation of Jesus Christ.
Okay, Paul says, look, I'm an apostle, and I have this message. Where did it come from? It came straight from the Lord. Had he had Peter or John or one of the other apostles show up, what might people have said about him? I mean, when you look at 2 Corinthians, people made all kinds of bad and false charges against Paul. So he already had a lot of things that he was struggling with as far as trying to deal with criticism. But did this save him some criticism because Jesus showed up? Yes. People couldn't say what? Well, Paul, you're an apostle because Peter came. And John came and he worked with you. John appointed you, or Peter was the one who gave you your authority. Paul said, I'm just going to dispense with that right from the outset. He said, that's not true. Jesus appeared to me on the road. He personally selected me. Now, it's true that I was the one who was born out of due season, so to speak. I was not with, you know, you guys, and I was not with talking to the non-apostles. I was not with them, but I'm a special circumstance. I'm a special case. And I'm just as much as an apostle. In 2 Corinthians is a great defense of Paul's apostleship. So why God did things, I think part of the answer is this as well. Now, you have Paul, or Saul. He's getting some really good news. Ananias, though, what do you think is going through his mind?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, this is not such good news from his perspective. In fact, I don't know if anybody has this in Acts chapter 9 and verse 13, but a word like but. Anybody have a but in Acts 9:13? There's a but in the Greek text, and even though that may be untranslated by most versions, Ananias answered and said, I've heard from many about this man. So he does begin with some objections, and that tells us that by this time in church history, or the history of the church, if you want to word it that way, Saul had done a lot of bad stuff. He says, how much evil he has done to thy saints in Jerusalem. Now, that word which is translated evil is actually plural in the Greek text. How much evils? Now, that probably would not be very good English, but to help us understand how awful Saul had been, It expresses plural. It is expressed by the plural. When you think about God's will, that's not obviously always our will. Can you think of some other Bible characters, famous characters, who God had a will for, but God's will was not their will?
Jonah.
All right. He's going to be one of the first that probably pops into the head. I mean, the last thing that he wanted to do was go and preach and teach to the Ninevites and have God save them. Who else?
Joseph.
All right. I think that you would definitely put him in that category. Anybody else?
Who did she say?
Joseph.
Moses.
All right. I think that you also have to put him in that same group. There were some things that he certainly didn't want to do. Anybody else come to mind? All right, Lot, you can go back to even Abraham. God says, Genesis 12 and verse 1, leave your family, leave your country. I doubt that that was something that he found to be very pleasant.
Job.
All right, Job, yeah. God's will was for him to go through all kinds of suffering. I mean, he's losing his family, his kids, and losing his possessions. So there have been several who have kind of wanted to say, hey, this is not my will. But God knows best, and sometimes his will is very difficult. We have almost, as I said, no information about Ananias, but we do know that people, when you think about them, they're told something, and oftentimes through their minds, different ideas, different scenarios can go. And if you were Ananias and God says, look, I want you to go see this guy, what might have been the first thought that goes to your head? God wants me to become a martyr. Now, God didn't give him apparently a long time to think about that, but I think as he hears that information, we know how much evils he's done to the saints at Jerusalem. The first thought that I think that might have popped through my head is I'm going to die at his hands. But God cleans that up. He takes care of that, and he makes that very clear that that is not going to be what has happened. Now, there's another thing I think that you have here. If Ananias was very familiar with Saul, do you think the reverse could have been true? Do you think that Saul could have been very familiar with some of the quote-unquote significant Christian leaders in the first century church? I do. Now, I can't say for sure, but since God selected Ananias, I'm thinking that he was not some pew warmer. I'm thinking that Ananias was, he may have been an elder or who knows what, but he probably was a fairly significant member of the church. Now, if that's true, and to me that seems to be a logical conclusion, is it possible, maybe not probable, but is it possible that Saul knew about it? And is it maybe possible that Saul had him on the list of people to go and grab? So again, there may be a lot that is unwritten, unsaid here that is also in the background. Interesting things to consider. Carol? You're going to say that. Okay. All right. Very good. Saul may have had a list of some other prominent people as well. But again, God quickly corrected that conclusion if that was Ananias' thinking, Acts 9, verses 15 and 16. God says in verse 16, which you haven't gotten to yet, somebody's going to suffer. But Ananias, it's not going to be you, it's going to be Saul. Now we do know that Ananias is a good man. Let's take a look at Acts chapter 22 and verse 12. Then we'll also look at Acts chapter 22, verses 14 and 15, and then skip ahead a little bit and see what we've got in Acts chapter 9, verses 15 and 16. Acts 22 and verse 12, who's over there and ready to go? 22:12. Dolores?
A man named Ananias lived there. He was a godly man, deeply devoted to the law and well regarded by all the Jews of Damascus.
Okay, now we've suggested the possibility that Ananias was a Christian. We really don't know. When you look at Acts chapter 22 and verse 12, you wonder if maybe he was a Jew. And again, that's possible. I don't know who he was, but he certainly was devout. There's no question about that. According to the law, again, you've got some Christians who were still doing some things that were Jewish in nature. They understood that the law had been taken away, but you still have them respecting some things. And maybe that's what he was doing, highly regarded by the Jewish people. We do know that he did do what God told him to do. Ananias was told to go to see Saul, and he, in verses 14 and 15, we've got a little more information about that. Dolores, you want to read those two verses as well?
Speak, for you are to be his witness, telling everyone what you have seen and heard.
Okay? And then coupled with that, you have Acts 9, 15 and 16. But the Lord said unto him, go thy way, for he is a chosen vessel unto me to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel, for I will show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake. Now, if you're Ananias, that had to be a lot to take in. I mean, you're told, you've got to go see this guy. This is my will for you to go. And, hey, wait, I have heard about this guy. And God says, well, look, this is what he's going to do. I mean, that is stunning news. And, again, you have one of the things that, to me, stands out about Mary. God says, look, you're going to have a child. You're not going to be married. And he's going to do all these great things. And from what we can tell, Mary was a fairly young lady, maybe 14, 15, 16 years old. Can you imagine, especially with some of today's teens, and that's not an indictment against all of our young people, but can you imagine some of today's teens getting that information, how they'd act? Not well. They would not be the vehicle that I would choose to bring the Son of God into the world. But you know, when you look at Mary, what'd she say? Okay. You know, that's fine. And she did do okay. All things considered. I mean, she really was magnificent. There are some people, you can give them some information, and they may not grasp it completely or fully. I mean, they sort of have at least the basic outline, and they will take it, and they will make it work out. But then you have some other people, they get some information, and they may be flippant, they don't care about it, or there's some other people, I mean, it just goes so far over their heads, I mean, they don't have a clue as far as what you said. But when you look at Ananias and you look at Mary, you begin to find some people that God looked at, understood what they were like, and, I mean, they really are impressive people. Anything that you want to ask? He apparently does not argue with God, right?
Ananias, like you say, we don't know a lot about him. But because he was involved with the Jewish people there in Damascus, it is very possible that Paul could feel a little more comfortable with him to begin with because he was Jewish. And then all of a sudden this Jew is telling him about what he needed to do to be saved.
Yeah. Yeah. Even in Jerusalem, remember at the end of Acts chapter 2? I'm going to write that down as far as a cross-reference. Having praising God and having favor with who? All the people. Well, would you say that all the people would refer to the Jews? Yeah. So here you have some Christians, but they still have, even though they have switched horses, so to speak, as far as religion, they still have favor with the Jews. And if you have that in Acts chapter 2, I don't see why you couldn't have that in Acts chapter 9. They're still friendly, and again, you know, maybe even though the Sabbath has been taken out of the way, maybe they are still respectful of that, not trying to throw that in the faces of the fellow Jews. So you can still accomplish both, as we see from Acts 2, and this guy seems to have had the smarts to do that. Anybody else? Let's take a look at this. When you look at, and this is going to pull from Acts 9, and you can also see it from Acts 22 and verse 13, but when you look at Acts 9:17, you have Ananias going to Saul, this famous persecutor of the church, and how does he address him?
Brother.
He addresses him as brother, and we want to talk about that for a couple of minutes. Ananias was told Saul already knew his name. We know that from Acts chapter 9 and verse 12, and he was told what Ananias was going to do. And here's one of the examples, this quick point before we talk about the word brother. Here's one of the quick points in the Bible as far as God's foreknowledge and man's free will. Let that sink in for a second. You have information about God's foreknowledge, what was going to do, what was going to happen. God said, Saul has seen what? He's seen this man coming to him. And the man who's coming to him is going to be who? Ananias or you. And what does he see this man or you doing? All right, his sight. Now, could Ananias have said no? Yes, he had free will. So God makes those predictions, if you will. He says this is going to happen, and at the same time you have Ananias also having free will. So again, I don't have a real good explanation for that, but the Bible shows me, it tells us time and time again that those two things do go together. Now, let's talk about this word brother for a little bit. Ananias refers to Saul as brother, and Luke records that twice, here Acts 9 and Acts chapter 22. Why do you think he did that? Now, some would say, well, look, he was a brother in the sense of a Christian. He was saved out there on the road, so now he addresses him as a brother. Well, now, wait a minute. If that's true, why does he need to go see him? I mean, God's already communicated the basics to him about what he's going to do. And we talked about calling on the name of the Lord in a recent class. So God says, all right, but God could have done that. Yes, okay. All right. I'll play it back with you. But in Acts chapter 9, and you also have it, see, there in Acts 22 or 26. I don't remember which chapter right off the top of my head. But God says to Saul, you're going to have to go and find out what you need to do, not what you need to receive. So he says there's something that you need to do. So the thing that he needs to do is become a Christian. But why call this guy brother if it's not because they're both Christians?
Well, maybe two things. For one, they were both Jews.
I think that's a great answer.
And the other one, just maybe, like, you know, you might call someone son and it's not your son.
Okay, that happens from time to time. One time I was in a restaurant with a relative. It was kind of a strange restaurant. It was a little buffet, and they had a variety of workers there. And by a variety, I mean that people were from different ethnic backgrounds. And this one fella, I would not want to guess his background because I would surely be wrong. But as we were trying to kind of finish up and get the bill and so forth, he came up and, brother, good to have you. Well, I wasn't connected to the guy. I'm absolutely sure of that because of skin color and because of some other things. I mean, there was just no union there whatsoever. But why call me brother? Maybe wanted a big tip, but why call me brother? Yeah, it was just a way of expressing a nice sentiment. You know, I realize that you're going to go. So son could be the same thing you have sometimes, people. I've got another relative, and when she sees me, and maybe it's forgetfulness on her part because she does have that problem, but she'll refer to me sometimes as son. And I'm thinking her son is about the same age as I am, and anyway, with the forgetfulness. So that may not be the best illustration, but sometimes people refer to someone as son. I'm not sure that daughter is used in that connotation. In that way necessarily, but we do have some words like that. What about referring to someone as mom or dad? You have sometimes a person who feels especially close to an individual and they refer to that person as mom or dad. Now, that's not true in a biological sense, and maybe that's not even true in an adoptive sense, but again, because of that relationship. So just because you have this word brother, don't point to that and say, well, aha, he had to become a Christian. I'm sorry. Verse 17 until next week. So that needs to be addressed, but I'm just going to shelve that for a week, if that's okay. So you can hold all your questions and bring them all out, but we're just going to delay that just a bit. Let's go back and talk about the word saints a little bit from verse 13. That is the first time that we find this word in the book of Acts. Again, you have a helpful passage here in verse 13 because today you find groups like Catholicism, they will say, saints, you're alive or dead? Dead. Well, if you're doing evil to saints, it sure sounds like they're alive or dead. Dead?
Oh, well, alive to start with, but the evil...
Oh, okay. Yeah, but if you're doing evil to them actively, yeah, that might kill them. But if you're doing evil to the saints, then that would imply that they are living people. When we think about the word saint, it is the idea of holiness. People have been separated for service to God. They're no longer living the life of sin. It's been said, and I like this idea, saints are people who are headed in the right direction versus people who have found perfection. I like that. People who are headed in the right direction versus people who have found perfection. So Paul, in his letters, after he becomes a Christian, starts to write, he uses this word about 40 times. Anything that you might add or ask? Well, Acts 9, 12, and 13. Let's take a look at verse 14. And here he hath authority from the chief priest to bind all that call upon thy name. Now, the word chief priest, it can mean a couple of things in Scripture. It might describe the person who holds that office. We've talked about Annas and Caiaphas at various times. Here, and you have some other places, I think it means the entire Sanhedrin. The entire Sanhedrin had offered these letters to Saul, and he was more than willing to take them. Now, it's very curious, at least to me, that Ananias, this fellow who's going to see Saul, Ananias had learned that Saul had authority from the chief priest to bind all that had become Christians. How did he know that? I don't know. I would think that there were perhaps some Christians in Jerusalem. They had runners during those days. They would run from city to city to communicate messages. And for a message that was this important, I suppose that they probably dispatched some runners to say, hey guys, this is happening. Saul's on the way and he has these letters. And we'll say more about that in just a bit. You find also, I think, an implied letter here. When we think about congregations, each one is autonomous. We know that from Acts chapter 14 and verse 23. They appointed for them elders in every church. But when you also think about autonomy, do you see some type of communication, perhaps some type of cooperation implied here? Okay, Acts 14:23 tells us that each congregation is independent, autonomous, separate from one another. But as you look at what is taking place here, do you see perhaps some kind of communication or some type of working together between congregations? Yeah. Somehow they got that news. So again, I don't know that you can extract a lot from that, but I think it does show that Christians were not forbidden from communicating with one another and very possibly working with one another. Let's make this point as well. We've talked about this in some other classes as far as self-defense and Christianity, whether or not that's right or wrong. But when Ananias says, hey, look, we know that Saul has come and we know his purpose, do you get the impression that these Christians were just going to sit around and wait for themselves to be slaughtered? I don't think so. It doesn't sound like that. It sounds to me, and again, you're having to infer some things here, but I do think that you see a little bit of implication that you have at least some of God's people discussing it. They were aware of it. They were talking about it. And why talk about, why discuss something if you're not willing to do anything? I mean, you can talk about the leaky roof, but if you're not going to do anything about the leaky roof, why talk about it? I mean, you can complain about it, but still, if it is a serious problem, it's going to destroy the house. People generally discuss things that they're going to take actions about. So when you look at this, it seems to me that there is an implied statement. There's an implied teaching there about taking some kind of precautions when it came to Saul's rampage. Anything that you want to add or ask on that point, Stan?
Well, at the very least, there's an indication from Ananias' response to the Lord that at the very least, by knowing that Paul was coming, they would be making plans to stay away from him.
Yeah.
Ananias' reaction was, hey, we know what this guy can do, and you want me to go to him? To me, the inference there is, no, I want to stay as far away from him as I can. So I would guess that at least that much was discussed.
Yeah, you might think if you got that information without much else or much else very quickly that, okay, God, you've told me, and I know that, and you're telling me this so we can go ahead and make plans to scatter or do whatever needs to be done so we can make sure that your people are secure. One other quick point on that, and this is, I think, kind of an oddity with humanity, but back there in 12 and 13, you have Ananias saying, well, God, this is what he's done. This is what he's coming to do. Don't you think God knew? Yeah, I think God was pretty well informed. But don't we have that same temptation today? Well, God, he or she or they or it. Doesn't he know? In fact, what did Jesus say back there on the Sermon on the Mount? God has knowledge of what you need even before you ask. So it can be a human frailty, but beware of telling God this, that, or the other thing. Now, you might tell him how you feel, but again, even then, does he know? Now, you can take that out to a logical absurdity and say, well, hey, why even pray if God knows it all? But the reason for that, as far as the prayer, is that is something that God has designed, and there's nothing wrong in communicating that. But it does, I think, behoove us to remember that God doesn't need to be told about this, that, or the other thing. And the same thing is true for those leading public prayers. He doesn't need to be told about things. Now, if you do that in a public prayer, I don't think that that's a basis for chastisement, so to speak. But again, just kind of FYI. Betty?
Even though God knows, he still wants us to ask.
Sure.
He still wants us to ask. He wants us to ask. Yeah. He wants us to communicate with him. He wants us to lay out our feelings. And that helps us.
It does.
Laying out our feelings and stuff. So even though he knows, he still wants that communication. And that's how we communicate.
It is. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I'm just... we want to make sure that we walk that fine line where if we feel like we need to tell God something, he doesn't need to be told in that sense.
Well, we don't need to tell him how you're supposed to do it. We need to tell him how we feel. And I don't think it hurts to ask.
No.
Ask for something, but we ask. We don't tell that, hey, I want you to do this.
respect him for who he is.
Yeah.
That it?
I think on a few of those occasions, people will say stuff to God like that, thinking they can, if they say it, maybe they can get him to change his mind, because they really don't want to do what he wants them to do. And they don't want to come right out and say, I'm not going to do it to God. But they figure if they can right pull a little bit, maybe they'll see things their way and make it where they don't have to do what they really don't want to do.
Well, and that's what you find with some of the great Bible characters. Moses, well, God, don't you know that I'm not the best speaker? Or Jonah, don't you know about those people? And it's almost like people think that they can argue their way into, you know, God's changing his mind somehow. I suspect there's some people who have that idea about the end of time, that they're going to be able to somehow stand up to God and, well, God, don't you know that I did all these things? And then he will. He already knows. And he's already given his law about how that's going to work. It's not going to work. But people still have that fundamental misunderstanding about God that they can somehow argue their way into a different decision by him. And we can do that with people. And sometimes people are very, very persuasive, whether it's the attorney or whether it's the child who is arguing with mom and dad or whether it's a disagreement between spouses. I mean, we're just geared. If it's not our way, we're inclined to go. I mean, things don't go right in a store. We're inclined to make our case and ensure that the management sees things our way. In the business world, I mean, it's just how life operates. You work on people and you do your very best to convince them. And all too often that gets transferred over in the spiritual realm. And that's a very bad thing to do. So, Dolores.
Don't you think even Jesus did that when he prayed in Gethsemane? You know, he wasn't braving to God. He knew what he was going to do, but it was like, I wish there was another way.
Yeah.
If you could find another way, but, you know, he was willing to do his will, but yeah, it was still a matter of communicating with God.
I think that goes back to the point that Betty was making. There is that honest expression, there are the feelings versus kind of the telling God or arguing him into a certain position. And that wasn't what Jesus was trying to do. Yeah, it is. Because, I mean, he already has everything laid out before him. So there's no way to go ahead and hide something. But trying to recognize that fine line, and sometimes we're going to be too far this way or too far the other way. But still, at least remember that. That it? Stan.
Excuse me. Sometimes by expressing ourselves that way, simply a way of saying, I understand, and this is how I feel. Whereas silence, of course, the Lord knows our heart. But I think, too, he wants us to express ourselves concerning these things so that we know how we feel about something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's multiple reasons why to express ourselves the way we do sometimes.
There are. Some people, this hasn't been something that I've relied on over the years, but sometimes people keep a journal. And they'll want to write down various things because that will help them sort out their feelings or help them understand their thinking process a little bit better. And it's just useful. It's kind of a form of therapy, if you will. And people do that in different ways. Sometimes it might be verbal prayer. People have different ways to accomplish those kinds of things, and you know, nothing wrong with that. But when you start getting into the arguing with God and telling God, then you start crossing into an area where you probably don't want to be. That it? Okay, let's say a little bit more about verse 14. The end of the verse has people, Christians, doing what? They are calling on the name of deity, perhaps Jesus. Now, we've already talked about calling on the name of the Lord. And as you look at that previous study, we're talking about calling on the name of the Lord from a perspective of non-Christians. But here, we look at the calling on the name of the Lord from the perspective of God's people. We saw that in the Corinthian letter, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Paul talked about the Corinthians. They were calling on God. If you back up a little bit in the book of Acts, Acts 7, 59 and 60, who do we read about at the end of Acts 7? Who's dying? Stephen. And what's Stephen doing there as he's dying? He is calling on the name of the Lord. He's being put to death. And then you're going to see this a little bit later in Acts chapter 9, if you move down to verse 21. And all that heard him were amazed and said, is this not he that in Jerusalem made havoc of them that did what? That called on his name. Well, you don't have Christians there simply calling on God's name, saying, Lord, Lord, but what are they doing? They're calling on his name in what sense? They are, okay, they're doing what God has said. Remember that verse over there in Luke chapter 6 and verse 46? Jesus said, "And why call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say?" Jesus said, is there anything wrong with calling on God? No. But true calling on God means what? You also do what God has said. So if you divorce one from the other, you have a problem. You think about calling on God, it comes from a pure heart. That's 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 22. And again, part of that includes obedience. Calling on God is just one more way to designate the saved from the lost. You have similar expressions. Those who call on God are truly the people who are the just, the righteous, and those who do not call on the name of the Lord. Just another way of describing the disobedient, the lost, the unjust, and the unrighteous. Anything that you want to add or ask? Well, it's 2 minutes to closing time, and we've got chapter X 9 and verse 15 left. Not the best place to start new, but at least we'll read verse 15. "But the Lord said unto him," that would be Ananias, "go thy way. For he's a chosen vessel unto me to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel." So many times we can look at something that is we prayed about and it's going in this particular way and we think that is the wrong way to go. If I were God, I would have made this decision. I would have gone down this course or this path and this would have been my selection. And that's easy to do. But in this case, Ananias is told, hey, this fella is what? He's going to be my chosen vessel. And I'm thinking if I were Ananias, you've got somebody who has all that history, somebody who has all that damage, somebody who has all that baggage. How can this guy possibly be of any use in your kingdom, God, let alone a chosen vessel? But once again, you come back to what we find back there in Isaiah chapter 55, verses 8 and 9. God said, my ways are not your ways, my thoughts are not your thoughts, and my thoughts are higher than your ways and thoughts. And we see that certainly with Saul. Carol?
Well, and just like you think Saul was definitely, I mean, look at him. He could not be the one you would choose to be speaking out for the Lord. But God had prepared him. I'm sure he had a lot of experience public speaking. He prepared him to be one that would be capable of speaking before kings and arguing the law. So he was preparing him for a long time.
Yeah, Ananias was able to see that short span, that short window of maybe 4 or 5 years. But God's going all the way back to the birth. And we might even say when you think about Gamaliel and the people who trained him, he's going back really from the beginning of time. Absolutely, all those things. You probably heard it before, but there's an old sermon illustration about two kids, winner and loser. Anybody ever hear that story? Well, the dad named his kids winner and loser. Obviously, he thought the winner was going to be a big winner. He thought the child named Loser was just going to be a loser from every perspective. Well, I don't remember all the specific details, but to give you the general gist, Winner turned out to be a loser. I mean, I think he was in prison and ended up to be a drunkard, and I mean, everything that could go wrong with the kid did. And Loser turned out to be the real winner. And I don't remember exactly what he did, but I mean, the dad was ultimately really proud of Loser and really disappointed with Winner. So it's like today, they talk about, you know, betting on a certain horse that's a really bad bet. You know, he's the one that ranks dead last in the race. Well, sometimes it's that black horse, sometimes it's that dead horse that you think there's no way it's going to win. And people sometimes have that with kids. They sometimes look at this child and they think, this is a child of promise, this is a child that's going to do great things. And maybe the child doesn't do, you know, bad things, but the child is the one who just has an average life, you know, working at the same job for 30 years and then, you know, everything just kind of continues in a very normal pace. And here's the other child who maybe had some special health difficulties or some other things in life, the child who wasn't supposed to live, whatever it might be, and that child grows up and you think, wow, I just could not have seen that coming. And then all of a sudden you look back on life and you think things just did not turn out as we thought. And hopefully that's a good thing, but we do get some surprises sometimes, but God always knows.